of similar procedures. So let me just get started. So the first thing I'd like to talk about is the kind of things we're looking for at the LHC. So an example scenario that we're very excited to find is supersymmetry. And a typical process in supersymmetry is represented by this Feynman diagram, where we have gluino production over here, and then you have what's called a cascade decay, where at each step you have one supersymmetric partner decaying to another one, emitting some standard model particle. And here you see that there's five decays, and then ultimately you end up with a neutralino, which is a neutral particle that's stable and leaves the detector. And in the end, this shows up not as quarks and neutralinos, but as jets and missing energy. So I've drawn the jets as these little cones, and the neutralino I'm just going to write like that with a U with a slash through it for missing energy. So really, what the signature of this thing is 10 jets and missing energy. This is a plot from Atlas showing the distribution of say, two particular points in SUSY parameter space, and they look at, for example, the number of jets. And the idea is that you can use this observable, the number of jets, to distinguish two different models. Now, in order to be able to see the new physics, you have to be able to understand the backgrounds. So this is also a study by Atlas of a background for one of these particular points. In this case, they're looking at 8 jets with some transverse momentum cut. And here's the signal, this yellow region, and they look at the background. And you see the background is dominated by simulations of QCD. That is, there's also processes in the standard model that have 8 jets and or 10 jets and missing energy. But the real question that's not evident in this plot is, can we trust the background? That is, what is the theoretical uncertainty on these green dots? You can sort of get a sense of the statistical uncertainty by the variation of them, but how do we even know if those green dots are in the right place to begin with? Now, to estimate this, what people normally do is compare different Monte Carlos. So this is an example of a comparison between two different programs, one called AlpGen and one called Herwig, for the same observable, which in this case is the minimum PT of jets in a multi-jet event. So this is a comparison for the PT of the first jet, n equals 1, and you see that the two Monte Carlos agree pretty well. For the next one, you see that there's a significant difference between this red curve, which is from AlpGen, and this blue curve, which is from Herwig. For 3, we're comparing this red curve and this blue curve. And for 4, there's a significant difference between this red curve and the blue curve down here. Notice that this is a log scale. So really what we're seeing is a factor of 10 to 100 in these 4 jet observable. And we need 8 to 12 jets for SUSY or more. This is a huge problem. If you just use this to estimate your uncertainty, you're going to find there's a factor of 1,000 uncertainty on your distribution. Now, obviously, these programs are using different physics to simulate it. And we'd have to know what's going into AlpGen and what's going into Herwig in order to be able to reduce this uncertainty. But this is sort of a rough estimate that experimentalists often use to estimate how well they can understand these backgrounds. This is showered. Yeah. It's just because they're using hard matrix elements. So they're showering the interface. This isn't comparison directly for matched matrix elements. It's just sort of raw matrix elements. But this isn't what? No, it's not. AlpGen has its own thing, the MLM method. I'll explain a little bit about the matching. I mean, that's actually a large subject of the first part of the talk. This is just the introduction. But this isn't just AlpGen and Herwig. So I also compare Pythia and Madevent. I use the same colors. In general, what I'm doing is comparing two different types of Monte Carlos. One is called a matrix element Monte Carlo, which Madevent and AlpGen is. And the other is a parton shower Monte Carlo, which are Pythia and Herwig. And you see also there's a huge difference. This is, again, a 4-jet event observable. And this one is actually divergent, so I just sort of cut it off by hand. So you can see that there's different physics going into these Monte Carlos. And we have to understand how to resolve that physics and how to come up with the correct distribution if we're to properly estimate backgrounds in a high-energy collider. So that's roughly what I wanted to sort of introduce the problem. To understand it, to solve the problem, we have to understand what's going into those red curves and those black curves. And to see that, we need to understand a little bit about how QCD gets simulated. So this is a rough cartoon of an event at a collider. On the left is sort of the incoming partons, the parts of the proton that are coming. On the outside is these yellow things, which is what you actually see in the detector. To simulate this, you break the process down into roughly 3 parts. The first part is the hard matrix element calculation. And this is what you use for your standard model calculation, or in particular beyond the standard model calculation you'd want. You calculate something using a fixed order finite Feynman diagram calculation. Then there's this middle part, which is known as the parton shower. And I'll describe this in the next few slides. And then finally, there's hadronization. Now, hadronization is the sort of messiest part of the whole business. But if you choose the right kind of observables, which are considered infrared safe, things that are really insensitive to the details of hydrogenization, and then you could tune it. In the end, this is something that we can handle, and I'm not going to discuss it further in the talk. What I'm going to talk is the difference between these two approaches and how they give vastly different results in collider physics environments and how to calculate the right answer. So let's see what goes into these two different segments of the simulation. First, the matrix element. What matrix elements mean is we're going to calculate Feynman diagrams. So for example, I calculate two diagrams, and you see you have to sum them and then square the sum to get the amplitude for a particular process. Now clearly there's going to be an interference term, which is the product of the two diagrams, which is important. It's a quantum mechanical fact that different processes contribute. It's not something you would get classically. But of course the interference is only important when these diagrams, by each diagram is roughly the same scale, which is when roughly there's some energy characterization of the different particles in the process are comparable. So I'm going to sort of describe this sort of region where the energies are all the same as the region where the matrix element calculation works. Now, you'd like, in principle, just to calculate the Feynman diagrams order by order to accurately simulate a process. But this is impossible for two reasons. First, the calculations are intractable for large multiplicities. If I tried to do, for example, a 16-body process, or even 10-body for these 10-jet events, it's just too hard. There's too many Feynman diagrams. They grow factorially. But even if we could calculate the Feynman diagrams, we wouldn't be able to handle the phase space. The phase space is just too complicated. There's too many peaks and valleys and structure in the phase space to possibly unweight it, that is to simulate the process using the amplitude, even if we knew the amplitude. But there's a bigger problem. The bigger problem is that the perturbation series doesn't converge. And when you do a fixed order calculation, you end up with terms like this. For example, at order alpha s, first order in QCD, you might get something with a large logarithm of a ratio of energies. But then you might find that if you did the calculation at order alpha s squared, you get the square of the thing that you got of order alpha s. And that means that if this log is big enough, that is, if the ratio of these energies is big enough, this log is so big that it overwhelms the smallness of alpha, and your perturbation series doesn't converge. This is a standard problem we've seen in many, many other contexts. And the solution is that this series has to be resummed. That is, we can have to come up with a prescription for understanding every term in a certain subset of this infinite series and add them all up at the same time. And this is called resummation. So resummation is what's done by the other approach to simulation, which is the parton shower. So parton shower uses essentially a classical approach to simulating an event. They say the cross-section for producing n plus 1 partons is proportional to the cross-section for producing n partons times some probability. This is known as a splitting function, or Altirelli-Polizzi splitting function, or Dieglap splitting function. It's a thing that's also used for the evolution of parton distribution functions, sort of universal object in QCD. And then when you have this sort of classical branching probability, you can also find the probability of no branching, which is just the exponential of the probability for branching. This is just like in any kind of Markov process. For example, radioactive decay, you always have an exponential probability for not decaying as a function of time. And that's all this is. And you just integrate the probability for emission, and you get the probability for no emission. So this is sort of a classical or semi-classical, if you will, approximation to what actually goes on. But in particular, it's all orders in alpha s, all orders in the strong coupling constant. You see that this appears in the exponent. So if you expand the series, you're getting terms not just of first order in alpha, but of all orders. So by doing something first order in alpha in the numerator, in the exponent, you get something of all orders in the final distribution. But obviously, we're using an approximation to get this, and the approximation is we're neglecting interference. The interference was important that when energies are similar, but this is valid when the energies are strongly ordered, that is, when the successive energies can be written in this way. No, it can be derived. In fact, it can be derived using a theory that I'm going to describe in the next few slides. But it could also be derived simply in QCD. It's a simplification of Feynman diagrams. Basically, the interference effects don't contribute in this limit. Okay, so back to this plot. So now we see that there's two regions here. This region where the energies are similar, where the fixed order matrix element calculation, which is what MadEvent does, is valid. So you sort of trust this calculation over here. And then the parton shower is valid over here when the energies are strongly ordered. And you see that this is going down to zero. This is the exponential suppression that we're seeing when the energy is strongly ordered. So you trust Pythia over here and MadEvent over here. But really what you'd like is something that's valid over the whole range. Okay, so what do people do about this? Basically, until at the Tevatron, this hasn't really even been that much of an issue, although now people are starting to try to deal with it. But it's something that people have really only addressed seriously in the last few years. The most popular scheme is this one implemented in AlpGen that someone asked about before, which is called MLM. And I just want to describe it briefly to illustrate the kinds of things that are going into our best simulations to date of the standard model. So what AlpGen does to combine these matrix elements and parton showers is they generate different samples at the matrix element level. So this is like running MadGraph. You generate different samples of different numbers of partons. For example, 2-parton, 3-parton, 4-ton. And then you shower them. So you just pretend you start the parton shower with these events using the pseudocode branching probability. Right? But when you do that, you're going to end up overcounting if you just add up those samples. Because the 2-parton will generate 3-parton samples, and then 4-parton samples. The 3-parton will generate 4-parton. So you'll get lots of samples that are completely covering the same regions of phase space. So you have to somehow combine them. And the way they combine them using in MLM, this is a scheme that Michelangelo Mangano came up with, is that he says, well, let's take each of the showered samples and try to match, so reconstruct jets with those showered samples and see if there's a one-to-one correspondence between the jets I reconstruct and the partons I started with. And if there's not a matching, I'm going to throw out the event. Right? And this is sort of a literal interpretation of the no branching probability. It's just saying if I shower them and they branch, that is, if I produce another jet, then something happened and I should throw that out because I'm supposed to be simulating the no branching probability and it branched. OK, so that's why it works. But obviously, there's problems with it. There's some technical problems. For example, it may not work for final state radiation. It may not work in certain regions of phase space. But more importantly, what is this? I mean, this is from the theoretical point of view, it's complete nonsense. I mean, how do you study this? How do you do it analytically? How do you estimate what the errors are in this? Right? I mean, this is the best we have. This is what experimentalists use because no one has provided them a better tool to work with. But from a theory point of view, it's really hard to justify. And more importantly, we don't even know anything to compare it to. We don't know what the right distribution is of these multi-jet events at a collider. That is, we'd like to have something that we could calculate in principle, theoretically. But we don't even have that. Right? We have these two limits where the energies are the same or where they're strongly ordered, where we trust our calculations. But we'd like something valid everywhere, and we don't even know what that distribution is. At least we didn't know. But that's where effective field theory comes in. OK, so why is this a problem for effective field theory? Well, you see that it's really a problem of these different energy scales. Right? As I said, there's these two calculations that apply in different regimes. And what effective field theories do is they let you calculate something at one scale and then evolve using the normalization group to go to a different scale and then integrate out the physics relevant at that scale and then evolve to the next scale relevant. So they let you do sort of fixed order perturbation calculations to do at each scale, and then they let you do the evolution using fixed order perturbation calculations of various anomalous dimensions and coefficients that go into your normalization group equation. So this is exactly the ingredients you need to combine these fixed order calculations with resummation. That is, in matching, that is at each energy scale, you're doing a fixed order calculation, which is like the matrix elements, and then the resummation is done not with these classical pseudocode factors, but with the normalization group evolution. So let's just sort of get a rough idea of what we're going to need in our effective theory. Well, first of all, we're only integrating out at each scale sort of hard degrees of freedom because we're evolving from hard scales to low scales. So we're going to need to maintain the long distance soft degrees of freedom from QCD itself. And those are soft and collinear fields. There's two kinds of sort of infrared structure to QCD, soft gluons and collinear gluons, also soft quarks and collinear quarks. So we better not integrate those out. So our effective theory should have as fundamental constituents these ingredients. And it should allow you to do all these things that I discussed in the last slide. And it turns out that there's an effective theory that's been shown to be self-consistent, was developed a lot for B physics applications, known as the soft collinear effective theory, that has exactly the properties we need to do this matching and resummation for jet physics. Now, this is not a talk on SED. I mean, it has some elements of SED, but I'm certainly not going to derive it or really present any details of the theory for you. It's got a very long history. It was really developed for heavy to light decays, where you have something like a heavy B meson decaying to a light field, like a pion, which leaves as a jet. So essentially, this is like massless compared to the pion, to the B, and you get a jet. So for example, B to pi pi would be something heavy decaying to two jets, which is exactly the kind of thing that we see in a collider. So this has been useful in some collider contexts, like deep inelastic scattering, but mostly in things like semi-leptonic decays and proving factorization in various contexts. But OK, I'm not going to get into details. I'm certainly not going to discuss any B physics here. But just want you to know that it's a very well-established theory that's been shown to be consistent in many contexts. One ingredient that, just sort of to give you an idea of what goes into it, is that it separates the gauge invariance of QCD into a separate collinear and soft gauge invariance. Really, it's a combination of collinear gauge invariances in many different directions. And this is manifested in the operators of SCET, which are written in terms of these jet-like things, which are really quarks, which are collinear fermions. That is, fermions with a label having to do with its the hard component of its momentum that can't change, and then some Wilson line. And I'm not going to define these things in any great detail, but you should know that it's a consistent theory that has some ingredients having to do with gauge invariants that make it simpler to calculate things and also simpler to prove things like factorization theorems. Now what you see is this object, which is really a Wilson line wrapping a quark, is a jet, which is exactly the kind of objects we want to study in a collider. So how do we apply this to the problems that we're interested in? I should say this is work that I did with Christian Bauer when I was at Berkeley. So the general condition in any effective theory is that you match at a particular scale by demanding that the effective theory reproduces the physics of the theory you're matching to at that scale. So in this case, we want to reproduce the matrix elements of QCD in the effective theory order by order. That is, we can build up these things, these C's, which are numbers, and this set of operators, which are operators constructed out of effective field theory fields, order by order in the QCD expansion. Now, it's very straightforward. At two jets, it's trivial. You just introduce an operator. Here is an operator with two back-to-back jets. Don't worry about the details of this. But I'm just trying to give you an idea of what's involved, and then you normalize to one. So this is just saying that at leading order in QCD, what I get from for example, E plus E minus to jets is two jets. Okay. But then we can go beyond this. We can calculate this Wilson coefficient at one loop. And this is where you really start to see the power of these effective field theory ideas. That you do these loops and you end up with finite answers. So in this case, what we're doing is calculating the alpha S correction at one fixed scale through the Wilson coefficient. And we do that by expanding the operators and expanding the Wilson coefficients and then calculating the matrix elements, again, at order alpha S. So to calculate a matrix element at higher order means calculating one loop. So what this means is that the Wilson coefficient at one loop is the difference between a loop in QCD and a loop in the effective theory. Now, the beautiful thing about effective field theories is that you're guaranteed that these differences are finite. That is, the important thing is that the infrared divergences, so these diagrams are generally both infrared and ultraviolet divergent. The infrared divergences are the same in the two theories because, remember, the effective theory has soft and collinear gluons, which are also the same soft and collinear gluons of QCD. And the UV divergences, of course, are different, but anyway, we have a normalization to deal with that, so they're never a problem in the theory below it in particular scale. So this lets you calculate a finite correction to the Wilson coefficient, and this has information about these loop amplitudes. And this is where we're going to be able to incorporate fixed order predictions consistently in perturbation theory. But we can do more. We can do higher order matching. That is, we introduce additional operators to account for the difference between the matrix elements of QCD for, say, a three-parton state and the matrix elements of sketch for a three-parton state. So in this case, this operator example will have three collinear fields in different directions, which I'm drawing as a three-jet operator. And this is again, the difference between the matrix elements and the collinear approximation. And remember, the collinear approximation is used by the parton shower. So this is what we're going to use to match the parton shower to the matrix element calculation. So this sort of explains how we do the matching, how we reproduce the matrix element part of view. That is, we're just making sure the matrix elements at a fixed scale in the effective theory match the matrix elements of the full theory. But we can also do the resummation. Now, resummation is done through the normalization group, and what that means is you have to calculate these things called anomalous dimensions, which have to do with the UV divergences. So you calculate some graphs in effective theory. I'm not going to go through the details of this, but in any case, there's some UV divergences. From that, you extract an anomalous dimension, and then you solve the normalization group equation, and you find out that the Wilson coefficient then at a lower scale is given by the sum, well, this integral. It's just a linear differential equation, so I can integrate it, which appears as an exponential. Now, you might remember that we had an exponential that was of a similar form from the parton shower, having to do with this splitting function. So now I'm giving you explicitly what a splitting function is. Remember, there was this Sudokov factor, which was integral to making the parton shower predictive when you have strongly ordered emissions, and it's an integral over the splitting function. So we can actually do this integral explicitly. And again, this is something I did with Christian. And we see that we had exactly the same form. That is, the evolution from the normalization group is equivalent at leading order to the evolution of the Sudokov factor. So this means that both the effective theory and the parton shower are summing the same logarithms, that we get the same answer in the two theories, but this is done semi-classically, and this is done through the normalization group. In particular, this is systematically improvable. We can do two-loop anomalous dimensions and three-loop anomalous dimensions, but here we're stuck, because once you have a probability, you only have a probability, and all you can ever do is integrate it. Okay, so what's the result? Well, so here again are these same two graphs that I showed you before. And here's the prediction from the effective theory, this black curve. So you see that it smoothly matches between this region, which was where the energies are all the same, and we trusted the fixed order calculation, that is the red net event curve, and the strongly ordered regime where the parton shower works. But by smoothly doing it, we can calculate this again, we can improve it, and we can calculate a more accurate distribution. But in particular, we get something that we can trust over all the phase space. Now, as I said, the big point of doing this is not to, well, this is sort of leading order. This is basically equivalent to what you get in AlpGen, although now we can study it theoretically. We have tools. Now that we know what it is, we can study it and we can improve it. In fact, we can work out a whole set of systematic improvements, particular things like higher loop resummation, higher multiplicity matching, higher loop matching for each emission. We can do all of these things in the effective theory. Now, this is something that I set up with Christian, but it turns out that actually in order to do any of these improvements, you need to know more details of the infrared structure, particularly the soft effects, which are not, they don't make a big difference at leading order, but at higher orders, they become very important. So we need to do things like derive factorization theorems and work out details. That's going to be the subject of the next part of the talk. But before I went on, I want to see if there's any questions about this sort of basic setup and use of effective field theory. Okay, that's great. Okay, so now let me change tone for a little while and discuss some applications of this. So really, I'm going to emphasize the systematic improvements of this Monte Carlo, but again, outside of the context of Monte Carlo, I'm going to discuss measurements of alpha f. This is a plot from the PDG of different measurements of alpha S from different experiments. And you see there's a whole lot of them, and they look roughly consistent. Again, all the alpha S's are the strong coupling constant is measured at a particular scale and run up to a common scale, which is usually used the Z boson mass, and then they're compared. And you see there's a very good agreement between them. And the average is very small. The average, the world average, is 1176 plus or minus roughly 2%. But what I'm interested here is this part noted E plus E minus rate, which comes from the left QCD working group, and they get something which has, it's a little bit larger than the world average, but in particular, it's got a very large uncertainty, right? It's got around a 5% uncertainty, which is totally dominated by theoretical effects. That is, these are observables that come from left. They're very clean observables. They're at E plus E minus collider, but it's things that we haven't been able to calculate theoretically. That is, they're limited not by the problems with the data or the experimental systematic errors, but by the theoretical uncertainties. In particular, I'm interested in one contribution to this, which is thrust data. Now, if we just use thrust alone, we find out that its central value is significantly larger, at least one standard deviation away from the world average, and the theory error is fairly large. It's got a 6% theory error. This is from Aleph. Okay, so let's talk about thrust. What is thrust? Okay, well, according to Herbie Hancock, it's when you take your spaceship to Machu Picchu. but for the more down-to-earth particle physicists, it's an infrared-safe observable, meaning it should be roughly, you can calculate in perturbation theory, and it should be the same roughly as the parton level and the hadron level. This is thrust data from various left experiments. They're color-coded for, you know, there's Opal and Aleph and Delphi and L3. They're all in here. And you see that there's remarkable agreement with them over a large range of thrust. To give you some intuition for this, you should roughly think of thrust over here in the sort of peak region as being two jet events. And over here, thrust is dominated by roughly spherical events. So fixed order matrix elements, where you have roughly lots of emissions at the same scale, that is this red stuff, my color code for this talk, correct over here, and then this has to do with the resummation, which has to do with the parton shower, which is what I discussed before that Pythia is doing. So roughly MadGraph would get this region right, and Pythia would get this region right, but the idea is that in a systematically improvable effective field theory, we can get the distribution right everywhere. In particular, we can use this to reduce the perturbative uncertainty on the alpha S measurement. So let me give you a history of this theory and what the problems are with it. So the first approach to event shapes, in fact, the invention of event shapes was around 1980, it's fairly straightforward to calculate them at leading order. The next leading order matrix elements involve canceling infrared singularities between loop amplitudes and phase space integrals. This was done by Ellis Ross in Toronto in 1980, and that's shown by this red curve here. Remember, this is this same fixed order thing, which is divergent, and you sort of trust it, well, over here in this region. The re-summation was done using the same semi-classical approach that goes into the pseudocol factors that goes into the parton shower by Kitani and Turner, Trentibu, and Weber in the early 90s. And that's this blue curve. So you see roughly the fixed order calculation undershoots the data. And well, with this particular value of alpha s, the resum calculation is too large, but then you can sort of match them, and you get something that's fairly accurate. But now, they have the same problem that the Monte Carlos have. They're stuck at next to leading log because they do the semi-classical approach to resummation. They don't know how to handle the infrared structure. They don't know how to handle soft coherence effects. They just have this approximation that at least gets them that far, but doesn't seem to get them any farther. So they've sort of been stuck since 1993 at next to leading log. What's worse, of course, the fixed order people have been stuck since 1980 at next to leading order until very recently. So there was progress in the fixed order calculation just last year, where after maybe 10 years of work, these four people finally finished the calculation of a next to leading order of these event-shaped distributions like thrust. And there's a tremendous amount of work. It was diagrams like this, where you have two loops and you have an additional emission that give very complicated infrared singularities. And combining them with other diagrams to show that all the infrared divergences cancel is very, very tricky. It took them a lot of work, and they finally came up with expressions that they had to run on a supercomputer for maybe 3 months to generate this distribution here. So you see, this is a plot from their paper where they show the leading order next to leading order and next to leading order with this value of alpha s. And you see that even at next to leading order, it's still under the data, so you're going to have to increase alpha s to get it to agree to the data. In fact, they did a fit to the fixed order calculation, which I've reproduced here, and they found that alpha s is 1.274 plus around 4% uncertainty. Remember, compared to this world average, the PDG world average, which is 1.176, is 2%. So now they're off by 2 sigma. Now they're off by 2 standard deviations from the world average, which is a bit of a disappointment considering how much work they put into this calculation. But their calculation is actually is extremely useful, except that it's not useful by itself. It has to be matched to a resum distribution. But as I said, the resummation was stuck in the early 90s at next to leading log because they used this classical approach, and nobody had figured out how to do a proper effective field theory treatment of resummation. What?
In principle, the usual case test resummation can handle the distribution to
arbitrary orders. No one has figured out a way to do resummation in the semi-classical way for thrust. Well, except that they don't know how to handle the soft effects. So the collinear emissions they can handle using splitting functions, and we have those to higher order. But the soft effects are very hard, and they don't know how to calculate the soft diagrams and incorporate them with the splitting functions to calculate these observables. I mean, if it could be done, they would have done it. But it's been 15 years since their original resummation, and they haven't gone beyond next to leading log. I mean, this is just the state of the field. But actually, I mean, one of the advantages of the effective field theory, at least using soft collinear effective theory, is that it does what you could do other ways, but it does it in a cleaner way using operators and at the level of Lagrangian by factorizing off different modes, as opposed to doing a sort of a Feynman diagram level, where at each order you have to refigure out which modes contribute to which processes, and it makes it very, very hard to do it systematically. Effective field theory just tells you, okay, compute this anomalous dimension, compute that fixed order result, and it sort of simplifies it. So once you have the factorization theorem, it's just a matter of computing the loops, and it tells you which loops to do. The other approach is, again, much more complicated. There's other advantages to the effective field theory. For example, it works in momentum space, as opposed to often they do this Mellin transform to work in operator products. So for example, deep inelastic scattering, and then you have other kinds of ambiguities. There's a lot of advantages. I'm not saying that the effective theory does stuff that no one else can do. I'm saying it does in a cleaner way, in a more systematic way, and allows you to go to a higher order. And that's what I'm going to show you here. Okay, so this was their theory. Now, the effective theory factorizes this expression into three parts. So this was a factorization formula I derived in a paper a few months ago. It was based on a factorization formula derived for the context of top physics by Ian Stewart, Sean Fleming, Andre Huang, and Sunny Mantri. So I should give them credit for really understanding the details of the factorization. I simply applied it to thrust, but understanding its consequences for massless fields, I think, is a very important application. So let me just give you a brief idea of what's going in here. First, there's this part over here, which is the hard function. This is roughly what corresponds to the fixed order matrix elements. So it's the difference between QCD loops and sket loops. These things here are jet functions. which are essentially the propagator for a collinear quark in a QCD background. So it's essentially some kind of spectral density that you can calculate order by order in perturbation theory. In particular, you can calculate it simply in QCD, but it has a nice definition in terms of operators in the effective theory. And then finally, there's the soft function. The soft function is, well, you can define it formally in terms of Wilson lines, but it does depend on the observable. And it's very hard to calculate these things in practice, but often you can use tricks to extract them from other calculations, which is what I was able to do. Okay, so let me give you some idea of what goes into these things. So the jet function, as I said, is this collinear propagator. It's known to two loops exactly, and the anomalous dimensions, that is the large log divergent parts of it, are known to three loops. So if I expand it, I get terms like this. Let me just briefly tell you what is involved here. What we're aiming for is a next to next to next to leading log root summation, which is two next to's better than the previous results. To do that, we need these ingredients. We need four loop beta functions. Four loop are called cusp anomalous dimensions, which corresponds to the leading divergent part of this amplitude. So here you see that there's a log, and then there's a 1 over p squared. For example, if I integrated this, I would get a log squared. That's why it's sort of the most divergent part. We need it at higher loop. Then we need this part, which is the finite part of, well, it's the finite anomalous dimension corresponding to the linear divergences, or the single logs, if I integrate this. And then we need these guys at one order less than that, which is two loops. So there's a consistent set of power counting that is known for this. Now, everything here is known for the jet and hard functions. The only thing we don't know is the soft function. So the soft function finite part, that is this part here, was known, well, analytically at one loop, I derived it in this paper. At two loops now, I can compute it numerically, and this is work I'm doing with Thomas Becker at Fermilab. And when we put this all together, we'll have this next to next to next leading log root summation. So what happens when you combine these things? You get some distribution, which is, well, don't worry about the actual structure. I just wanted to show you that it's actually an analytic formula, that this is something you can just evaluate. It's a function. It's a function of thrust and alpha s. So there's only two things that go into it, and all these things like CF are Casimirs, which is known given QCD. So really, it's only a one parameter family of distributions having to do with alpha s. So it'll be very good for fitting the strong coupling constant. And you can do checks on it. For example, if you expand the resum distribution to fixed order in alpha s, you see that it should reproduce the divergences, that is the singularities as t goes to zero of the fixed order calculation. And here you can see explicitly that it does that. In fact, I'm showing this I can show it graphically also. Now this is the fixed order expansion of the resum distribution in blue, and the fixed order expansion itself is red, again using the same colors I've been using before. So this is a non-trivial check on this effective field theory. What it does is it reproduces the divergences of the fixed order calculation. So now we can do it also at next leading log. So again, comparing the one loop, the next leading order QCD calculation with the expansion of the resummed expression in SCAT. And you see that it agrees remarkably well. In fact, what's surprising is that it agrees not just in the peak region where it's supposed to agree, but it also seems to agree fairly well also into the tail. In fact, we can use this expression to calculate this missing part of the soft function. So to do that, let me just show you that actually you reproduce each color structure separately. It's not just the total distribution, but actually each of the separate color structures you can also reproduce. So that's shown here. And by using the difference between these curves and subtracting from the total cross-section, we can reproduce this finite part of the two-loop soft function, which is what's going in to this expression. And that's all we did. Now we can do next to next to next to leading log resummation, which I'll show you here. So this is still the fixed order expansion of the resummed expression. And what I'm comparing to in red is the events from this 10-year calculation by German and collaborators, which is shown in red. And you see something funny is happening here near the peak. And really what's happening is that their events, their simulation, remember, which they ran on a supercomputer, and there's a large cancellation of positive large numbers and negative large numbers to give you something finite, it becomes very, very bad over here in the peak region. So what's happening is they're not converging. But you see this is a non-trivial check on their calculation, and it agrees remarkably well over almost the entire region of thrust. In fact, we can compare it not just at the total distribution, but each of the color structures separately, which is what I've done here. And you see that we reproduce all, there's six color structures relevant, and we reproduce them all in the effective theory. This is a remarkable non-trivial check on their 10-year calculation. In fact, we can go better, and we can expand near the peak region. So let me do that here. And you see that this is a log plot now. So this is really very, this is, you know, e to the minus 8 the thrust is e to the minus 8 over here. So you see that actually they're underestimating. These lines are, okay, the different lines are different infrared cutoffs they use to cancel the really large divergences in their theory, and the red is a statistical uncertainty that they thought they had after running their supercomputer. And you see that they're really underestimating their convergence in this region. But the effective theory actually agrees. I mean, you can't even see a difference in this log plot over most of the regime. I mean, of course, it just has to do with the scale. But in general, this shows that they underestimated their error and is a very non-trivial check on their calculation. Okay, but the point wasn't to check their calculation. The point was to reduce the theoretical uncertainty on the alpha S measure. So let me show the fit to the olive data. First, let me compare the resum to the fixed order calculation. Again, you see the fixed order diverging and the resum actually converges. But now actually we're getting the structure fairly close in the peak region. And if I match the two, I get something that actually goes through the data with a much lower value of alpha S, that is much closer to the world average. But let me actually do the fit. So I'll show you here, this is a fit. I'm comparing different uncertainties. The green is the statistical uncertainty and the yellow is the systematic uncertainty. And you see that actually, and this is the data, so this is really the quality of the fit. And you see that actually it's pretty good over this entire fit range. It's actually fairly insensitive to the fit range. So what I did was I also fit to a larger region. This was the fit range the fixed order people chose. You see the resum distribution can go farther into the peak, but also can actually go farther into the tail because it accounts for a higher order effect that the fixed order doesn't even do. And you see that actually the value of alpha S is fairly insensitive to the fit range, but the chi-square improves as we increase it, which is a very important check on the consistency of the calculation. Let me get to the results. The important thing of the alpha S fit is not the value of alpha S, but the uncertainty. And so it's very important to have an accurate estimate of your theoretical uncertainty. In the effective theory, there are four separate scales that can be varied, as opposed to the fixed order calculation where there's only one, which is the hard scale. And you see that by varying, so these are the soft scale where I integrate out the soft modes, the jet scale where I integrate out the collinear modes, the hard scale where I integrate out QCD, and the scale that I match for the fixed order calculation. You see that these two are very small uncertainties. And I should mention, these are these scales. This is equivalent to the scale that the fixed order people are varying. And this is, again, because alpha S is small at those scales. It's not sensitive to the large values of alpha S that are relevant at lower energies. But here you see that there's a significant uncertainty, but also that you get very nice convergence towards the data order by order in perturbation theory. In fact, I can compare the fixed order estimate of the uncertainty from just varying the hard scale to what I get from doing it with the effective field theory. This is the uncertainty band method of estimating uncertainties, which seems to be the standard technique for estimating uncertainties on perturbation theory results. Some of these things are kind of technical, so let me just I'll discuss them only if people are interested in. But let me get to the final results. So this is a fit to the olive data and the opal data. These are the lines from right to left and the bands from back to front are the different orders in perturbation theory. And you see that it converges very well. There's remarkable consistency between the opal and olive data. The central value for olive is 1174 plus 13. And for opal, it's 1178. So averaging them, I get an uncertainty of basically 1% and a central value which is remarkably close to the PDG world average. You see that we have now the new best measurement of alpha S from, and this is also from collider physics observables, as opposed to this, which is dominated from low energy measurements. For example, lattice contributes a lot to the world average. So I think this is a very important confirmation of the power of effective field theory. It's allowed us to go to higher orders consistently, and it actually agrees with the data better than previous results and produces a smaller uncertainty. Oh, absolutely. So hadronization Monte Carlo. So I skipped the slides on non-perturbative effects because I wasn't sure if people were interested in. So hadronization, it's a very interesting question. So the way people model hadronization for most of these studies, in particular like the fixed order calculations, they'll run Pythia at the hadron level and the parton level. They'll calculate a transfer matrix and then sort of hadronize their distribution with that matrix. Okay? There's a number of reasons why that doesn't make any sense for this calculation. First of all, that's the same Monte Carlo that's been fit to the same data we're trying to reproduce, right? So you're using something that already has the answer in it. Secondly, it's a leading order shower, so it's sort of a leading log resummation, and you're trying to correct the leading log resummation to account for hadronization, but you're really also accounting for things beyond hadronization, such as things missing in the shower. And so it didn't make sense to do that. Really, what you want to do is estimate the hadronic uncertainties with purely theoretical methods. And that can be done also within the effective field theory context. So what you do is you factorize out something called a shape function, which is universal. A leading order is just a power correction. And then you fit that universal power to all your different data points. So it's sort of one number, or maybe two numbers if you have a subleading power. You should be able to fit them for one data point and then use that same number for all the data points. So you get additional degrees of freedom, but you know how they scale with energy. That's the proper method, and that's what we're doing here. So I'm going to come back in the next few slides to Pythia because it's a very interesting question. But before that, are there any questions about this alpha S measurement? It's correct in different kinematical regimes. Alpha S at what scale? That's the problem, right? Because thrust is actually sensitive to many different scales. If you look at these distributions, there's actually the natural scale for there's a hard scale where you integrate out QCD, which is the center of mass energy. So for example, the Z boson mass for the LEP1 data, 92 GeV. But there's also a scale when thrust gets lower, the fixed order calculation doesn't know that, and they're still only sensitive to alpha S at that one scale. But really there's, for example, a scale for so thrust is roughly like a jet mass, right? So when that jet mass goes down to 30 GeV, I have a jet scale, which is 30 GeV. So I'm sensitive to alpha S at that scale, right? So that alpha S is much larger than alpha S at a higher scale. So I'm actually sensitive to a perturbation expansion in that value. I also have the logarithm of those two scales, right? So I'm also sensitive to perturbation expansion when that log gets large, right? And then there's also a soft scale, which is sort of the seesaw scale between those two, which is parametrically lower than both the jet scale and the hard scale, which is, gives you alpha S at scales maybe 10 or 5 GeV. Some sensitive to alpha S there. So you have much more dynamic region, and that's why in these plots, that's why the soft scale is a much larger variation because it's sensitive to much lower energy. So actually, the perturbation expansion, you have a good perturbation expansion. It's an expansion in anomalous dimensions and fixed order calculations. But to estimate the uncertainty, you have to do uncertainty on alpha S, for example, you have to do one of these uncertainty band techniques to really see how well you're converging, because those sort of simplistic ideas about convergence don't really apply. Right. So in effective theory, it's much more under control. I think you may be referring to like log R matching and things like that, which are techniques that the fixed order people use to combine with resummation.
No, but for example, you have to put the fact that the smaller phase space allows for the division of large distances or large angles. And that's not what is included in
Right, but actually, so the effective theory lets you control that, because these appear as power corrections in the effective theory, and they're parameterized by a higher dimension operator. So remember there was that O3 that I introduced in the beginning part of the talk? That the matrix elements of that operator account for the differences also in the phase space between the two states, because one comes from an emission of two quarks, and one is a matching to a two quarks and a gluon matrix element in the full theory. So by doing the matching in the effective theory, you can control these things and absorb the power corrections and operators in a controlled way. Okay. I mean, part of the work that I was doing with Christian was to establish how to do this matching systematically in effective field theory. Okay, now let me get you to some exciting LHC applications, which is really the fun part of the talk. First, let me talk about Pythia a little more. So you asked about this hadronization correction. Let's just compare Pythia to the data. So this is Pythia just run at the hadron level compared to the olive data. And this is my fourth order resummed result. Right? Now, here you see Pythia agrees perfectly with the data everywhere. Well, the resum result, okay, so this that it doesn't agree in the peak region in the sense is this power correction, it's the hadronization. But it agrees here. But remember, we're doing all this work. We're calculating for loop things and matching to this 10-year calculation. And we're getting something that's worse than Pythia. Right? So why does this happen? Well, obviously, this is tuned to data. Right? It's tuned to this data. So of course, it's going to agree. But what's being tuned? Right? Now, normally people expect that it's the hadronization that's being tuned, right? These are the sort of fragmentation functions. The vast majority of the parameters that are tuned have to do with the fragmentation models. So let's turn that off. So here's Pythia run at the parton level. So you still see here it does get the structure right in the peak region. This is this hadronization shift that we expected. But still it's agreeing with the data remarkably well, considering how it's a leading order shower and leading log resummation. That is, it should agree with this thing, which is what I get when I run the effective field theory calculation at leading order, that is tree-level matrix elements and leading log resummation. So the point is this red curve should agree with this green curve. Instead, it agrees almost closely with that curve. So what's happening is Pythia is mucking up something about higher order resummation into their Monte Carlo, even though they don't have a leading auto reformation. So they're pretending there's physics that's not there but actually is there, and they're doing that so that they agree with data. Well, this sounds fine, but how do you know that it's going to work, for example, at the LHC? Well, let's try a process that we actually can calculate or can calculate at the moment, which is the ILC. So here's the same plot run at a TEV. Now you see that Pythia agrees with the leading log shower. It also agrees that the parton to hadron corrections are very small. So you see that Pythia and the leading log shower actually, Pythia is what it's supposed to be if I run it at a TEV. The various tunings that I've done, which muck up power corrections, are very small. But actually, the correct calculation, the for loop calculation in the effective theory, is significantly larger. This is about a 30% discrepancy. That means that these Monte Carlos are underestimating the backgrounds at a TEV by 30%. Right? This is a really big deal. Right? This is something that people haven't been aware of because they didn't have calculations that were accurate, that were more accurate than the Monte Carlos. Right? They don't have calculations that they can trust the collider observables, particularly in the peak region where you need higher order resummation, that they trust better than the Monte Carlo. But here we have one, and you see that the prediction is that the Monte Carlo will underestimate the background by 30%. Now, this is at a linear collider. What about the LHC? Okay, so here's a similar calculation at the LHC. It's not thrust. It's something else that's like an event shape called a heavy jet mass, which is essentially a mass it's like a hemisphere mass. So that you assume that everything is two jets, and you take all the soft radiation and combine it, compute an invariant mass. And I just ran Pythia and computed this thing, and you get a peak. Now, what do you think the accurate calculation, if I did this at four loops, what would it look like? Well, there's a good chance it would look like that, right? It would be something probably significantly higher than this region, because again, this is sensitive to partonic center around the TEV. But what's important is that we can calculate this. This is something that can be calculated accurately in the perturbation theory. Now, it's true it's a little bit more complicated because it involves hadronic collisions, but that's not something that effective field theories can't handle. They've been doing that for a long time. In fact, we have next to leading order parton distribution functions. But what's being run in Pythia are leading order parton distribution functions. It's such a waste that we have all these beautiful data, beautiful HERA data that's still being taken to get really accurate PDFs, and what we're using is leading order PDFs in a Monte Carlo. Actually, if you do the effective field theory calculation, you can match to those higher order PDFs and calculate these things accurately. Not only can you calculate them, but you can get error estimates. In the same way I got error estimates for the thrust distribution, I can get theoretical perturbative error bars on this distribution. Then you can take this to the LHC, go measure this observable, and see if what you're doing. You can use this to tune your detector. You can use this to look to physics. You can use this many, many applications. In particular, it's an independent check on the physics, independent of the Monte Carlos. This is something I think is very important for the LHC and stuff that I'm working on now. But actually, this stuff has more applications. So let me get to I have two more applications I want to discuss. One is for supersymmetry. So this is a lightning review of some SUSY phenomenology. If you've never seen a talk on SUSY phenomenology, you're not going to follow this. But I'm just going to give you a rough idea of what's involved. Okay, so the first panel is it's sort of a simple SUSY process that people like to consider, where what's happening in the production process is this quark. And then the quarks decay to neutrinos, and then they decay to leptons, which finally decay to their missing energy, which in this case, I've just written it as a neutrino. So what happens, what do you see here? You see that these two quarks appear as jets, and these two leptons appear in the detector, and you get missing energy. So it's two jets, four leptons, and missing energy. And what people like to look at are things like dilepton invariant masses, where you take these two leptons, where you take the different combinatorial combinations, and you try to reconstruct things, look for peaks. So the invariant mass of these guys should give you information. It should give you an edge corresponding to the mass of this quark, things like that. This is considered a relatively clean process because leptons are clean. They appear as lines in your detector, and you know their momenta. Something like this is more complicated, where you don't have any leptons. You just have a bunch of quarks. So these quarks appear. So again, this is a cascade decay, which appears as six jets in missing energy. So the kind of observables people look at are, well, they take these jets, they take the parton, the showering of the quark, they reconstruct the jet, and then they try to construct a dijet invariant mass. So basically what they're doing is they're pretending that the quarks are leptons. They say, well, in a really ideal world, we'd be able to reconstruct the parton level process exactly, and then we'd get a jet. But, well, it's not ideal, so let's take a jet and pretend it's a parton and do the best we can. What I'm going to show you is that actually by doing this, you're throwing out a tremendous amount of information. That thinking that jets are more complicated than leptons is very dangerous and I think misses a large point of doing jet physics at colliders. So to see this, let's take a simpler process. Here's just squark, squark, decaying to quark and neutrino. This is one of the simplest processes of supersymmetry and one of the hardest to study. The signature of this is now two jets in missing energy. Because you have two neutrinos, it's very hard to get a handle on anything about the missing energy signal. There's also a large background. But in particular, you don't have a good handle on the kinematics of this. For example, it's very hard to measure the squark and the neutrino mass. It's hard to even measure the squark mass. The best idea that most people use, or the experimentalists consider, is to look at cross-section. You just look at, you know basically the coupling constants. So you look at the total cross-section, and this gives you a handle on the squark mass. But actually, there's a lot more information here. So what's happening here is the squarks are decaying, but remember, it wasn't just a quark, it was a squark. So it's not just the quark decaying into a jet, which is what I showed here, but actually the squark decays. And what you get is a squark showered jet outside of a quark jet. So in particular, if the squark is highly boosted, you'll get a large jet here, which is this blue cone, which is much bigger than the shower due to just the quark. And then you can do something like construct the invariant mass of this jet. It'll be sensitive to both the squark mass and the neutrino mass. The squark mass appears as in the hard matching scale where I'm calculating this jet. That is, it's a matching scale. It's a threshold scale where I match the effective theory. The neutrino mass is the scale where I integrate out, I essentially integrate out the squark and I end up with a jet and a neutrino. So both of these scales appear in an effective field theory calculation. What I'm saying is we can calculate this accurately in effective field theory. This is something that we can do, and we could probably calculate it to three loops. And this is very sensitive to both the squark and the neutrino mass. Moreover, it's completely complementary to traditional approaches, where you just say the squark is, for example, if you did this calculation at the parton level, which as many SUSY studies are done, you would throw out this information completely, because the quark mass is zero at the parton level, effectively zero. So just to see if this works, I ran the simulation at the LHC, but using Pythia. So Pythia does some kind of rudimentary approximation to a squark and quark shower, but I ran it for a bunch of different squark and neutrino masses, and you can see that there's sensitivity to both the squark and the neutrino mass for a large range of different energies. In particular, I picked some points, like this black and the red ones, which have the same squark and neutrino mass difference. And in that case, you see that actually you still can distinguish the two curves. Now, I'm not saying that we should trust Pythia for this. I'm saying that we can do this calculation accurately, and it's an observable that you can trust that you can do an effective field theory, and it's completely complementary to previous approaches. And in order to see these observables, you have to embrace the fact that jets have structure. You have to use jets and use the shower and understand the shower and not be afraid of it, like many traditional SUSY analyses have been done. Finally, I have one more slide, which is something I just did on the plane over here, so I don't even know if it's right. But it was an idea actually suggested by David Kaplan, so I should give him credit for it, which is that you have these accurate calculations, which, as I said, are sensitive to many, many different energy scales. So you can use it to look for additional light luminos, light-colored particles. And actually, there's a very weak bound on the existence of, for example, a light luino. For example, the current bound, I think, is like 6 GeV. So there could be a luino of 7 GeV, and we wouldn't even know about it. But actually, you're sensitive to it because it appears in the running coupling. So what I did, it also appears, so if you do a fixed order calculation, for example, at one, fixed order calculation of thrust or the total cross section, you're only sensitive to alpha s at one scale. But when you do an effective field theory calculation, you're sensitive to alpha s at many scales. So you really see where this threshold is for the gluino. That is, it contributes to the running, not just of the beta function, but also to the jet anomalous dimensions and the soft and the hard anomalous dimensions, which all go into the effective theory calculation. So putting all these thresholds in, I redid the fit for the Aleph data, and I find this black curve is the value of alpha s at mz with an additional gluino, where this is the gluino mass. And this is the running of, this is just compared to the, just running alpha s up, assuming there's an additional gluino at that threshold. And you see, for example, where this goes 2 sigma away from the running is something like a bound you could put from a low energy observable with doing this fit. And you see that it puts a bound of roughly 20 GeV. But actually, if you did a more accurate calculation using high energy data, you could get something like this, which would put a bound of maybe 50 GeV, if you're lucky. And of course, reducing the errors, reducing the systematic error, or the theoretical errors on this curve would improve the bound dramatically. So this is just to illustrate the power of these ideas, that using resum distributions is very sensitive to new physics at many different energy scales, and is a complementary probe of all these observables to the kind of things that people have been using. Okay, let me just conclude. So I showed the first part of the talk, I described how effective field theory sort of rewrites the idea of generating an event into modern language. so that you can do a systematically improvable calculation. I showed the power of these systematic improvements by redoing a fit to left data. Now we have one of the world's best measurements of alpha S. In fact, the error is smaller than the PDG world average. And it's much better in particular than the fixed order calculation, which is, you know, is a significantly larger factor of four larger error and is off by the from the world average by two standard deviations. I showed the effective field theory has many, many useful applications. It'll be useful for calibration if we can calculate observables like jet masses. It gives us new handles on new physics. It lets us calculate observables like squirt jet masses, which are complementary to things people are doing at the parton level. It lets us calculate things like, you know, Galeno mass bounds. It has many uses. It also, for example, there's applications to Randall Sundrum models where you have a gluon decaying the CP bar pairs. You have hard tops. That's something that's also can be calculated in effective field theory. I mean, there's just tons of applications of this stuff. You know, each time I think about it, I can come up with a new idea. I think this is sort of the future of the way these calculations are going to be done. And I hope I gave you some impression of the way this could work. If I do what? Like hold hold the squirt mass fixed. Yeah. Well, I'm not trying to match them. I'm trying to show that they're different. Yes. Yeah. There might still be a degeneracy, is what you're saying. Yeah, that's true. But again, even if there is a degeneracy, this is an observable that's zero at the parton level. So it's complementary to other studies people do for the same type of process. So there's somehow you can combine this with other studies, try to see if even if there is a flat direction, it's somehow complementary to other observables. It might be. It's true. It might be. It might be, but it won't be in the proper effective field theory calculation because it's some really complicated nonlinear function of the hard scale and the jet scale, which are both sensitive to the squark and neutralino mass. So if I did this calculation correctly at three loops, I can guarantee you that it would be sensitive to both scales. Why? You mean it might be dominated by other errors besides theory uncertainty? Yeah, if we can't measure these things properly, I agree, there's an issue. This is just the first start of this project. I just wanted to illustrate that it's observable that's complementary to other approaches and something that we can actually calculate. And then to see if it's useful is of course, on the bottom line. But that has to be done only after you calculate it. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. No, it might be, but this observable is complementary to the parton level observable. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know if Pythia is doing this properly anyway. That's another thing that might be wrong. But yeah, of course, you have to do a proper study. I mean, this is the start of a project. Yeah. What does it mean? This is just a cartoon. I mean, this is the. You mean how is the blue compared to the orange? Yeah. Oh, well, it would be the invariant mass. Yeah. So it's, what you would do is take, it would look like a two-jet event. So you take all the hadrons in that event and construct a jet mass, add all the four momenta, and then square the thing. And that's the thing that this is a representation of what I was plotting. You like this part? Or this? This part? This? Good. Got it. Oh, come on, this is just a cartoon. This is. Oh, but there could be a large angle, sure, absolutely. And the neutralino can go off any which way. Why not? I'm not saying we're just finding the orange cone inside the blue cone. I'm just saying we're plotting the mass of the blue cone, and it's sensitive to scales that determine the shape of the overall blue cone. Blue cone is a jet. That includes the orange jet. But I don't find the orange jet in it. I'm not looking for the orange jet. I'm just plotting the mass of the whole thing. And that's the thing I'm calculating. Okay. Yeah.
I wanted to ask about going back to the alpha S, the systematic error on that.
Yeah.
Kind of a tricky little question, but the dominant systematic, can you go back to that slide and I can point? The dominant systematic error, as I remember, was actually somewhat different between the two experiments, but you're deriving that systematic error, right?
No, not for the experiment. I'm taking that from their papers.
So where it says...
This is from their analysis.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't point out, these systematic errors, I can't do the proper analysis because I don't have the correlations between the systematic errors among the data.
Right.
I have to work with experimentalists to do that.
Well, I remember, but I don't remember for LEP. I remember for PEP1, for the habitization part, people were literally very parameters in the habitization Monte Carlo.
Yeah, no, it's horrible.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Yeah. Yeah, we can do that properly. And this is another, it's another set of work.
So before you did your analysis on this, because you're shifting the central value some way, but the statistical error is from you here, right? Is that?
No, that's the data. The experimental system, the statistical error. I don't have any statistical error. I'm running an analytic calculation.
Well, I thought that before you quoted an error. I have
a totally different question. It seems to me I'm not working on the other two. It seems to me there was great worry presented at some talk that you had about large uncertainties in the background of jet assumptions in the not 30%, but factors of 3 sort of.
Yeah.
Do you already have any insight into that? I mean, do you think you'll be able to do better?
On jets and missing energy in a lepton?
And lepton. There's a variety of signals. There's some of them were used to justify the funding of the LHC and turned out to be totally wrong.
Right. No, it's a difficult question. I'm not sure what the effective theory is capable of. I know it can do QCD processes. When you want to do electroweak processes, you have to couple them to QCD, and they're essentially external to the operators we're interested in. People haven't really studied that kind of matching in detail. People are starting to think about it, but there hasn't been really work. Certainly no comparisons to data, but obviously it's critical and something that we're going to need to do at some point. Hopefully we'll get there.
Well, can you see where certainly the factors of 2 and 3 and
right.
Come in,
but that has to do with the first part of the talk where I had these Monte Carlos. So when you run those different Monte Carlos, when you have jets and missing energy, when you do matching, it has to do with the matching schemes.
Yeah.
So the fixed order calculation can differ by the resummed one by a factor of 1,000.
Yeah.
Right. So that's those errors are much bigger than the errors. But if you have a calculation that you trust everywhere, then you can actually estimate the uncertainties better than just by comparing two different Monte Carlos.
Mm-hmm.